The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
And today I thought I would continue talking about the Second Noble Truth. I've been talking about the Four Noble Truths now for a couple of months, kind of exploring in detail the various teachings that the Buddha said that all of his teachings were subsumed in the Four Noble Truths. So I'm kind of exploring the variety of teachings around the Four Noble Truths. So over the past 3 or 4 weeks, I've been talking about the Second Noble Truth, the truth of the cause of our suffering. And so I thought I'd continue talking about that today from yet another angle. So, in our lives we have found many times that when we get what we want, it makes us happy to some extent. We find that over and over again, actually, we see, kind of a feeling of dissatisfaction when we want something, and that when we actually get what we want, it's like, oh yeah, this is the way it's supposed to be. This is good. I like having what I want. And we also see that when we don't get what we want, we're unhappy. We suffer. It's like particularly, we tend to put the cause of our suffering out into the world. It's like, I don't have that thing, or I have that thing and I'm afraid it's going to go away. We're focused out on the world in terms of our desires and our wantings and our not wantings. And we think, because of so much evidence that getting what we want makes us happy. We have that happen over and over again. When we get what we want, we're happy. When we don't get what we don't want, then we're not happy. I mean, you see this in babies. Babies have this, right? You give them the toy, they like it. You try to take it away, they get unhappy. It's like, this is a very natural phenomenon that when we get what we want, we have some pleasure there. It feels good to get what we want. But this has happened to us so much that we have come under the spell, the delusion, the belief that the only way that we'll be happy is if we get what we want. And this creates some difficulties for us because we can't always get what we want. Wasn't there a song called something like that? So we don't always get what we want, and then we really suffer. We suffer because of that. Our relationships aren't just what we want, our homes, our environments aren't just what we want, our jobs aren't just what we want, and we think there's something wrong with us because things aren't just as we want. We've been taught that happiness comes from having what we want, and that, especially in this culture, we've got the possibility for doing anything, and so it's like, well, if you don't have what you want, then there's something wrong with you. We have that kind of belief. And so the whole way it's not just this culture, actually. It's human nature, and I think all cultures tend to reinforce this notion that getting what we want is what makes us happy. And because of this kind of, it's kind of so visceral, that when we get what we want, there's a feeling of relief, a feeling of the satisfaction, that we have what we want. That we don't even possibly conceive there might be another way to happiness. So one of the things that we can begin to notice, as we bring mindfulness to our experience, we turn mindfulness to our experience of wanting, And we begin to see, part of what we begin to see is that when we do get what we want, there is some happiness that comes from having what we want, some happiness from that. Or if we get rid of what we don't want, there's a happiness that's kind of a feeling of, oh, I'm in control here, I've got things figured out. But what we actually begin to recognize as we turn our mindfulness towards this experience itself, towards the wanting in particular, either the wanting or the not wanting, they're kind of two sides of a coin. And in the second noble truth, both the wanting to have things that we like and the wanting to get rid of things that we don't like are included in the second noble truth. And so what we begin to discover as we actually pay attention to this wanting is that part of the happiness of having what we want or getting rid of what we don't want comes because the wanting goes away when we get what we want. And this is the beginning of the recognition of the truth, the second noble truth, that to a large measure, the dissatisfaction of the wanting creates its own suffering, and that we're essentially trying to fill the void of that wanting itself. And then we get what we want, and so we have the pleasure of having what we want, and we also have the pleasure of the release of that wanting. And that's actually the bigger part, at least in my own experience, of observing this wanting. The fact that the wanting goes away is actually the greater part of the happiness of having what we want. And so this is what the Buddha is teaching us about in the second noble truth. He says it's the wanting that's the cause of our suffering. It's not the not having. It's not the not having that causes our suffering. It's the fact that the wanting is creating that feeling of lack, that feeling that there's a hole there, and we have to feel like we fill that hole. So if we can begin to observe the wanting, begin to get familiar with the wanting, how it comes to be, what causes, what's the kind of process by which this wanting comes to be, then we begin to understand that there's a different way to happiness, and that is by letting go of the wanting. That when the wanting disappears, when the wanting goes away, the suffering goes away. Now, you know, this brings up the question a lot. Why would anything ever happen if we don't want things? There's kind of two approaches to this, two answers, two ways to navigate this question. And one is that because we have this habit of thinking that getting what we want will bring us happiness, we kind of feel like it's the wanting that is the engine by which anything happens. And so we don't kind of recognize or see that there are other possible motivations for doing things. We kind of think that the wanting to do things is the main motivation for doing. And there's a component of like an intention to act. I mean, if we don't have an intention towards action, you might think of that as a kind of a wanting. But if we don't have an intention towards action, there's not going to be an action. But the wanting that's referred to in the second noble truth is kind of more got a neediness to it. It's got a sense of it's not going to be okay unless this is the outcome. So it's not going to be okay unless I have that chocolate. That sounds like a silly example, but you know, just it's there's that feeling of with this craving of the second noble truth, it's not going to be okay unless I have this or unless I get rid of this. But there's some fundamental problem in our world unless we change that situation. Another motivation for acting can come out of kind of a more wholesome wish for happiness or compassion at seeing suffering, that with that seeing of suffering, there comes a natural wish to act to alleviate that suffering that doesn't come out of necessarily ill will or hatred of that suffering, but comes out of an open heart. And so this exploration around the wanting that causes suffering, one of the ways we can look at it or explore it is, where is the heart contracted or closed? If the heart feels contracted or closed around needing to have something or having things to be a certain way, there's some craving there. There's some wanting there that is not so helpful for us. If the heart feels open and connected in taking action, do that action. You know, there's no reason to have a sense that, well, okay, because there's some wanting there, you know, I want to help these people, that I shouldn't follow through on that. If there's an open-hearted connection there, that's the kind of motivation that's skillful to follow through on. So there's still perhaps a kind of wanting in there, but it's not this wanting of having to have things be a certain way. So we can explore the sense of compassion as being a motivation for our actions, rather than this neediness to be a motivation for our actions. So our suffering, the reason why we suffer, have stress, feelings of dissatisfaction. The Buddha pointed right to this sense of neediness, this sense of craving, as being the kind of focal point. That if, again, as I said earlier, if the suffering, if the craving goes away, if that wanting goes away, then the suffering goes away. And so all of the ways that we suffer at some level have some kind of holding on to them, a denial of things as they are. This is another way to look at the craving, that essentially we are, you know, we're meeting our experience moment to moment, and things as they are, it's not okay. You know, that we feel like there has to be some change to things as they are. So essentially it's kind of this wanting around the Second Noble Truth is around wanting things to be other than they are right now. Now, that's to say, you know, okay, right now, right here, right now, there's some experience already happening. If there's any kind of sense that this should not be happening right here and right now, there's going to be suffering about that. Now, this is not to say that we would necessarily just sit in this place of suffering and just say, okay, well, you know, this is the way it is, you know. We may take some action, again, out of compassion, out of meeting that suffering. We may take some action to step into the future with an intention to alleviate that suffering. And this is the whole way that the Buddhist path unfolds, essentially. You know, there is a kind of wish, desire, kind of a movement towards freedom from suffering. In a sense, I think our whole being is set up this way. We want to not suffer. And we just misunderstand how that not suffering would come to be. But when we start to bring a mindfulness to our experience, when we start to turn towards this process of suffering as it's created, towards the wanting, towards how that wanting is created, we begin to recognize that there's been a misunderstanding, essentially. There's been a kind of a misunderstanding about how we can be happy. And the Second Noble Truth teaches us that the way towards the happiness is to let go of this wanting. The wanting things to be other than they are. And, you know, the movement towards awakening, you know, this movement towards not suffering, you know, that It's kind of like our being is set up to go towards not suffering. And as we see the mistake that we've made, that thinking, having, that's what's going to make me happy. When we actually see that the having, well, it makes me happy for a little while, but then I just have to want something else in order to get to have something else. And so we end up on this kind of cycle. And we see that that's not terribly satisfactory. So with mindfulness, with turning towards our experience, we begin to actually recognize that the way we have been functioning to get what we want hasn't been terribly helpful for us. And so the mindfulness begins to point another direction. And so this desire, this wish to be happy is still in effect. It's just that we are understanding this kind of misperception about how happiness can be. It's really the letting go of the wanting that allows the happiness. And so our system being set up to go towards happiness, to go towards not suffering, when our mind starts to see that it is the holding on to things, the trying to manipulate, to change, to control the environment, and seeing the unsatisfactoriness of that, the mind starts to let go of that. And it moves in a direction towards a deeper kind of happiness, the happiness of letting go. So the main thing I want to talk about today is the kind of whole process around which this wanting happens. The Buddha actually had a very detailed description of how this whole process comes to be. And I won't go through the entire thing. It's a 12-link process that, he says, you look at all these different things, and it's, this thing causes that. And then when that happens, it causes that. And when that happens, it causes that. And look at how all this unfolds, and it just leads us right into suffering. So he saw very clearly kind of this 12-step process that our minds go through over and over again that keeps us hooked, basically, into this pattern of wanting. And it's basically this pattern I described, that there's something pleasant in our environment or something unpleasant, and we like the pleasant, we don't like the unpleasant. We want to have the pleasant, we want to get rid of the unpleasant. And in having that satisfied, having that wanting satisfied, there's some happiness that happens there. There's, oh yeah, I've got it, I figured it out. But that moment, that happiness only lasts a short time. And so, what happens to us at that moment is it's like, well, the last time I was happy was when I got what I wanted. So what can I want now so that I can get what I want in order to be happy again? And so we end up kind of on a cycle. We have something. I mean, we want something. We get it. We get a bit of happiness. That happiness fades. So there's a little bit of suffering around that fading of that happiness, and we think, well, what was the last time I was happy? Well, when I had what I want, so what can I want? So we're back on that cycle. So it's just this loop. And the Buddha described this cycle in 12 steps. And I'm only going to talk about a few of them. So I'll start from basically our bodies. We kind of have this body. It's got these sense bases, these sense doors. We see, smell, hear, taste, touch. And there's the mind, which in the Buddhist psychology is also considered a sense base. Things come into the mind by the other sense bases. And, thoughts come in, emotions come in to the mind. So, like our eyes see, our ears hear, our mind experiences thoughts. Our mind also produces thoughts, so the mind has got this double door to it, kind of, with sight, there's things out there, objects out there, chair. The eye sees the chair. So that there's the seeing that happens based on things that are outside. With the mind, there is the mind that experiences things. It experiences thoughts, it experiences emotions. And the mind also produces these things. So it, like the eye sees sights, the mind experiences thoughts, and the mind experiences emotions. The mind also produces those things. So it's kind of got this two-sided nature to this sense door of the mind. So based on our body and mind, experience contacts us. Hearing, we hear, we see, we smell, we taste, we touch. So there's things that happen in our minds. So there's this, based on our body and mind and the fact that that we're alive, there's this contact. We experience contact with our senses. That experience of contact, whatever it is, whether it's a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, a touch, or something happening in our mind, whatever it is, there is a feeling to that. And the feeling, this is a key point in this process around the wanting. The feeling is either pleasant, it's unpleasant, or it's neutral. Neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So the, whatever we're experiencing, everything has this kind of feeling to it. This pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Not the feeling of emotion here. This is a really simple kind of feeling. Just a very bare sense of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Based on that feeling, in a very normal way, we see this in animals, we see it in children, in babies, everybody. We like what's pleasant. We don't like what's unpleasant. Neutral, we may tend to space out around. We may not tend to notice it much at all. So we tend to go towards the pleasant. We like the pleasant. It's like we gravitate in that way. Yeah, I'll give me some more of that, thank you. So this is where our wanting comes in. Or our not wanting, if it's unpleasant. Oh, let me get rid of that. Well, let me figure out how to get rid of that. So this link in this, kind of we experience things, we've got our body and mind, and because we have this body and mind, there's contact with the world. Based on that contact, there's this feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Based on that feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, as a kind of a connection between the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, we move into this wanting. We want the pleasant, we want to get rid of the unpleasant. It's just like a kind of a very automatic response, in a way. It's kind of, even single-celled creatures do this kind of response. They'll move towards food and away from some kind of noxious chemical. It's a very natural inclination to move towards pleasant and away from unpleasant. So there's a naturalness to it, but what happens to us is that we transform that kind of natural movement toward, in a way, pleasant and unpleasant to a neediness. Like, it's not okay if I have unpleasant in my environment. It's not okay if I don't have this pleasant thing in my environment. And so this is the craving. This is this craving of the second noble truth. It arises out of the feeling, but it seems kind of hardwired in a way that we do that. Just thinking about how an amoeba works, if an amoeba does it, wouldn't I do it, But it's not hardwired in us, this craving. It is an option. And it is basically this option is informed by a misunderstanding. That we basically, because we misunderstand where our happiness comes from, we think that we have to get the pleasant and get rid of the unpleasant in order to be happy. So that fundamental misunderstanding informs this process. And when there's pleasant things in the environment, because of that misunderstanding, the craving results. And so this feeling tone, the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral aspect, is a key component of this craving coming into being. But the other key component is this misunderstanding. So it's not actually necessary to want the pleasant or want to get rid of the unpleasant. It's an option. We can have pleasant things arise and be at ease when pleasant things arise. We can have unpleasant things arise and be at ease when unpleasant things arise. So we don't have to have this kind of push-pull attitude about everything that happens to us. We can be balanced around what is arising. So from that craving then arises this whole pattern of holding on, clinging, having to have things as they are, and we're back in the cycle. Once that happiness of that having has gone, faded, we're back into this cycle of, well, there's some other pleasant sense contact. Maybe if I get that thing, that will make me happy for the next split second. And then I can find another one, and then I'll be happy for that split second. And that's what we think happiness is, chaining together a bunch of moments of getting what we want. So the in this cycle that the Buddha describes, it's really interesting to notice. So he points to this place of feeling and the misunderstanding around feeling as those two things coming together to create our wanting. And the wanting is what leads us into this cycle over and over again. And if we can let go of that wanting, we find that we're much more at ease, that we don't have to want things. We can just kind of simply respond naturally without having to have things be a certain way. You know, there would be a natural response if you find yourself in a, you know, a smoke-filled room to get out of the house. You know, that it doesn't have to be around, I hate the smoke, you know, I this is horrible. You know, it's just like, no, the natural response out of compassion is get out of the house. So it doesn't have to have that feeling of craving in order to act. So the point that the Buddha kind of is pointing to here is this notion of the feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, kind of being a springboard for us. We react to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And that reactivity is essentially the craving. It is the wanting. It's the reactivity to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral is this not accepting, not liking things as they are, not having an acceptance of things as they are. So since this feeling is intimately connected with this process of how our wanting comes to be and how our suffering comes to be, can be really interesting to explore this feeling, the feeling tone. And that's kind of the main thing I want to explore today, is how do we look at feeling? What is, and why does this help us? So partly, you know, just to kind of give you the direction that I'm going here. When we start to observe the pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral aspect of our experience, and this is, you know, it's a subtle experience, but it's actually only subtle because we don't normally think about it. We almost always will just automatically react to it. But if it's highlighted for you as something interesting to pay attention to, you'll actually notice it's pretty easy to see. It's pretty easy to recognize. You know, you hit your knee on the corner of a table, and it's unpleasant. I mean, it's pretty obvious that it's unpleasant. But we don't normally actually notice that unpleasantness because we immediately leap into the reactivity. Oh, so stupid. I'm always walking into the furniture. Why do I have to do that all the time? So we, you know, we don't actually acknowledge or notice unpleasant just occurred. We immediately leap into the reactivity. Or pleasant, you know, eating ice cream. That's pleasant. It's really obvious. When we start to highlight this quality in our lives in terms of paying attention to it, it's actually pretty obvious to us. We're just in a cycle, a flow of pleasant and unpleasant and neutral throughout our day. And if we don't notice it, we're automatically kind of reacting to it because of this habit of thinking that this arrangement of getting what we want, getting rid of what we don't want, will be how we can be happy. So if we begin to recognize this flow of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, the awareness, the mindfulness of it, the mindfulness of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, can, it doesn't always, but can begin to short-circuit that automatic movement into reactivity. We can just notice, oh, that's pleasant, or that's unpleasant. And we don't have to then leap on it and have to do anything with it. We just recognize and appreciate, oh, pleasant is happening right now. Now, this isn't about not appreciating when we have pleasant things or when pleasant things are arising for us. We can appreciate them. Actually, we can appreciate them more deeply when we're not trying to manipulate somehow to make it last or to have more of it. There can be a kind of an appreciation that's just like, oh, this is the way it is right now. We're actually meeting it more fully and appreciating it more fully. Likewise, when we meet unpleasant, a lot of the unpleasantness that happens around meeting unpleasant is our idea around how unpleasant it is and how much I need to get rid of it in order to be happy. So if we can just notice, oh, there's an unpleasant experience, and not have all of this mental proliferation around the unpleasantness and about what this means for me, this means I'm a failure, this means I'm... I don't know how to do things. It means all kinds of things we think it means when we have unpleasant experience. If it's just unpleasant experience and it doesn't have all of this ripple ramification, it comes and it goes because pleasant, unpleasant, neutral is impermanent. It's actually really impermanent. The Buddha compared it to a bubble on the surface of water. You know, when there's rain falling on a pond, you get these little bubbles that appear. They just appear for a moment, they kind of float and pop. That's what feeling is compared to, just a bubble. It's got a little bit of, it lingers for a little while, and it pops, it goes away. And so if we're not attaching any meaning to the pleasantness or the unpleasantness, we'll just see it's a flow of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And so the mindfulness to this quality of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral can begin to short-circuit our natural reactivity towards this. Wanting. Now there's a range of this quality of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And it's really helpful to start to get familiar with this quality of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. You know, it's not just that pleasant or unpleasant. There's more like there's really pleasant. You know, there can be things that are really pleasant or things that are really unpleasant. You know, if you get in a car accident and your, you know, arm breaks and, you know, it's your bone is sticking out of your skin, there's probably some extremely painful sensations going on there. Really unpleasant experience. You bruise your knee by, you know, walking into the corner of a table. There's a different level of unpleasantness going on there. So there's a range. So getting familiar with the range of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and you'll see that it just is a flow in our lives through these qualities. The easiest place to begin to explore this quality of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral is in our physical body. The sense base of touch. The sense base of touch is really obviously pleasant and unpleasant. In fact, in the Buddhist psychology, it actually says that the sense base of touch is always either pleasant or unpleasant. It's never got a neutral tone to it. So even this contact of my hand here on the table in Buddhist psychology says it's always pleasant or unpleasant. And actually, if I allow my attention to kind of go in there, there's a little bit of unpleasantness in the places where the bone is touching. It's a little bit of just very slight unpleasantness. Then the softer parts, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, kind of softness and pleasantness to that soft touch. So there's a very subtle kinds of pleasant, unpleasant, unpleasant experience with our sense base of touch. And so this is a really obvious place to notice it, that the neurons of our skin are designed to recognize pleasant and unpleasant. So that's the best place to begin to explore it. Just getting familiar, you know, washing the dishes. You know, sometimes, you know, we get an idea that washing the dishes as a chore is unpleasant, but if you actually pay attention to what's going on there, you know, you may find that the immersing your hands in the warm, soapy water is kind of pleasant. You know, there may be some unpleasantness as you have to hold on a dish tightly, you know, the kind of tension of your hand. But there's a flow of pleasant, unpleasant sensations in that experience. So this points to then the place, another place where we have pleasant, unpleasant, neutral sensation experiences in our minds. And this is a large place of where our suffering happens. So this example around washing the dishes, you know, if you have the idea, well, dishwashing's a chore, I don't like to do this, I've got better things to do, that unpleasant thought has an unpleasant, you know, it's got an unpleasant feeling tone to it. There's a belief, an idea there that is coloring our experience. And in large measure, the vast majority of our suffering is actually coming out of some unpleasant thought, idea, belief in our minds. So there's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral flowing through our, you know, sense experience. And we create beliefs and ideas around it. And those beliefs and ideas have a pleasant, unpleasant feeling to them. And so this is another area for exploration. Are our thoughts, our beliefs, creating a kind of a filter through which things become unpleasant or pleasant, for that matter? So, you know, if we have this belief around dishwashing, that we've got better things to do, then we may not be able to notice the flow of pleasant and unpleasant sensations because we have this whole idea around it that it's unpleasant. So that our ideas can actually create like a filter through which we see other experience. So this belief around dishwashing creates a filter so that we don't actually notice the pleasantness, the pleasant physical experience around the dishwashing. So getting familiar with feeling means getting familiar in the body. You know, in the sitting practice, this is an easy thing to do. You know, often in sitting still, unpleasant experience comes up, and we typically will react to that. Again, the reaction is the, you know, it's like there's a, you know, maybe an itch. You know, itches are a really good thing to observe this way. You know, itches are not going to be dangerous for you, you know, but they tend to be really unpleasant. You know, they tend to drive us nuts. So, you know, if you notice the unpleasantness of an itch and then begin to notice the distinction between the actual physical experience of unpleasantness and the whole mental construct around that, you know, this is driving me crazy. You know, what's the problem with scratching an itch? You know, if we move into the mental realm, so beginning to distinguish the physical, what's actually a physical sensation versus the mental response to it, and whether the mental response to it is pleasant or unpleasant. That whole exploration, particularly around the distinction between body and mind, the pleasantness and unpleasantness in the body, the pleasantness and unpleasantness in the mind, you'll really start to see that the vast majority of what we end up reacting to is something in our minds. It's an unpleasantness in our minds. You know, even the pain of a broken bone, you know, what we react to isn't so much the physical pain itself, but it's an idea, it's a belief, this is a problem. And it becomes a huge, what am I going to do? How am I going to drive? How am I going to feed myself? You know, we that's the vast majority of our suffering, is not so much the physical, but it's our mental response. This is not okay. So in looking at this pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, beginning to kind of distinguish what's physical, what's mental in terms of this pleasant and unpleasant quality. Let's see. There's so much I could talk about pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Well, here's another piece I'll put out there. I'll give an example, the kind of point to, again, this kind of feedback loop of having an idea which in turn changes how our feeling is experienced. So, and to begin to make this, to distinguish where the unpleasantness is coming from. So if there's some kind of reactivity, this can be an interesting exploration. What am I actually reacting to? Is it the physical thing that I'm reacting to, or is it some idea? So at one point, I was meditating. It was kind of late at night. It was the middle of the night. I'd gotten up because I couldn't sleep, and so I was meditating in the middle of the night. And, you know, I was just meditating and noticing what was going on. And at some point, I heard this tapping noise. It's a really quiet kind of tapping. And my experience, you know, there was contraction. It was like my experience was this was unpleasant. You know, this sound was unpleasant. And I, you know, just kept watching. I was, you know, doing my mindfulness, and the sound would disappear. And so I got a chance to just not, you know, just be kind of at ease with what was happening. And then the sound would reappear, and be like, okay, what is this experience? You know, that it feels like this is unpleasant. But in the observing, what I noticed is that when the tapping happened, there was a contraction in the body. And the contraction was unpleasant. Clearly, the contracted body was unpleasant. So, okay, so there's that contraction. So I was noticing the contraction and the unpleasantness of that. And then at some point, when the tapping went away and it came back, and just as it came back, I noticed the subtlest hint of fear that arose as the tapping began. And the contraction was a response to that fear. I hadn't noticed the fear before. I had just, you know, noticed this unpleasant tapping noise. But the subtlest kind of fear was there. And the fear itself was unpleasant. The fear was unpleasant. The contraction was unpleasant. After I noticed the fear and I noticed the contraction being unpleasant, the next time, so I, you know, could just be with the fear. The next time the tapping came, I recognized that the tapping itself, that sound itself, was pretty neutral. You know, it was not actually, it was so quiet. You know, it wasn't like a leaf blower or anything that's really loud or noisy. It was just this quiet little tapping. And it was actually neutral. And I saw in that moment the kind of conditionality of how feeling is created. You know, that through this lens of fear, which was not seen initially, the interpretation of that tapping was as unpleasant. And so this kind of exploration can be really interesting to do, that we look at what is actually happening here. I was reacting to fear. There was a fear present. That's what the unpleasantness was coming from. And as I, you know, just kind of sat with the fear over time, the fear began to diminish and, you know, there wasn't so much of a problem anymore. It was just the tapping sound and it was just, that's all it was. So this kind of feedback between our minds and our bodies and how it plays with this feeling tone, very interesting kind of exploration to make. Let's see, what else do I want to bring in here? Maybe I'll stop there and just see if there's any questions. I mean, basically the main reason I want to point to this as an exploration, is because as we start to really recognize the feeling, we start to see how we leap off of that kind of automatically into this is not okay, I've got to fix this, I've got to change this. And we see that is where our suffering is coming from. It's not actually the thing that is pleasant or unpleasant. It's some idea. And so this exploration of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feeling, both body and mind, begins to really point to where our reactivity comes from. And it comes from our own minds. When we see that, when our minds see that they are contributing to our own suffering, our minds start to let it go. It's kind of a natural result of that awareness, of that knowing. That's insight. That's how insight works. And thank goodness we're built this way, you know? bringing in this mindfulness, bringing in the mindfulness and the understanding of how it's the two pieces. It's the mindfulness joined with some understanding of how this process works that begins to point us in the direction where the mind begins to let go more and more of that reactivity that it's doing to itself. So, comments, questions, anything? Yeah, Mary.
I'm wondering if part of this process is going from pleasant, unpleasant to neutral, so that the very same tapping, if your mind is clear and you haven't brought all the background to what that tapping might stir up in me, that I would begin to treat it as neutral.
Yes. Now, so that there are, in a way, this is another piece of the Buddhist psychology. I mean, as I said, the physical sense base is going to be pleasant or unpleasant. You know, kind of, the nerves are designed to experience pleasant, unpleasant, but because over time the reactivity diminishes, and the vast majority of the unpleasantness comes from the reactivity, it gets much less, it's much less of a problem. Although, I have to say, if your bone is broken, broken bones are probably one of the most painful, painful things we can experience, so I hear. So you will experience that unpleasantness, but there won't be the reactivity to it, as we move into this letting go of the reactivity around our pleasant and unpleasant sensations. Now, so that's with physical experience. Another very interesting thing to explore and to play with, and this is a teaching. I don't know that I completely believe this teaching, but I'm going to put it out there. This is what I think it's in the Abhidhamma, the Buddhist psychology, which is kind of common. It's kind of a later exploration of the teachings of the Buddha. That of the other four physical sense bases, seeing, smelling, hearing, and tasting, they are all inherently neutral. That there is no pleasant, unpleasant sight, sound, smell, or taste. That if there is a sense of pleasantness or unpleasantness in that sense base, it's because of a reaction in the mind. It's because of an idea, a belief, a view, a response. So I find this really interesting to explore. I don't know that I completely believe it, particularly around taste. There's certain tastes that I've had that have just been, it goes into the back of the tongue and it's like an automatic gag reflex, because it's like, this is dangerous. Don't swallow this, don't put this in your body. So I don't know, whether this is actually true or not, but I have seen this is a very interesting thing to explore. Like this tapping, essentially, that sound itself was neutral. It was the reactivity of that tapping shouldn't be there. What is that tapping? I wonder what's making that noise. This is what all the fear was, coming from. Maybe it's a mouse in my wall. Maybe it's a rat. Maybe it's something worse than a rat, That was going on in very subtly in my mind that was coloring that very neutral sound. And so it's interesting. And like with sight, the sight itself, if we look at just what sight is at the bare level, it is form and color. And whatever we see actually, is an interpretation in our minds. There's a perceptual process that by which we recognize things. So we recognize chair, woman, man, wall, carpet, colors. We recognize all of that. We recognize it in our minds. So the form and color itself, just a kind of pastiche, like a painting of form and color, is the bare sense of sight. And it's what it gets interpreted into in our minds. Rose, decaying corpse, that it becomes pleasant or unpleasant. So it is that idea of rose or corpse that has that pleasant or unpleasant quality, not the actual sight. That's my understanding of that teaching. But the idea isn't to kind of deny that there's pleasant or unpleasant experience going on for us, but to kind of, for me at least, it's an interesting exploration. So, I'm experiencing unpleasantness here in my sound. The sound of the leaf blower. If that's unpleasant, if that seems unpleasant, and it's at a far enough distance away, and it's not damaging the ear, if that seems unpleasant, there's probably an idea in the mind that is contributing at least to that unpleasantness. And so as we see the ideas, the views, the reactivity in our minds that contributes, things do start becoming more neutral. There's kind of an inherent lessening of that reactivity, yeah.
When I first started meditating, I started to feel like I was dumbing down. And I didn't like that because much of my pleasantness has been, intellectual challenges, et cetera, et cetera. So I did think that was happening, and now that's fine. And now from today, I'm starting to see that emptiness and clarity is the closest thing to truth you can have.
It's true, yeah.
And I mean, that's astounding. When your whole life has been built around reading this and knowing this and memorizing the 12 Buddhas this and the 5 Buddhas this and the 3 Buddhas.
It's true, and we begin to see, I think what you're pointing to is a kind of a notion of identification around, being the one who knows. And, as we see that, actually the clarity that comes as we let go of the thoughts and ideas about what we know, the clarity that comes is way more amazing than our thoughts about it.
True, really, yeah. True. Yeah.
Any other questions or comments?
Now I can know that and want that, and it just doesn't come because I know that.
Know the clarity, want the clarity.
That's the value. It's going to take a long time for me to get where.
Yeah, and there's, this is a point, and this is probably a good point to close with, that, so there is a wanting in a way. We see the benefit. We have a taste. We have a taste of that clarity. And then we start to want it. And, we can kind of see, that the wanting has two aspects to it. One is that it's not okay if it doesn't have that clarity right now. That's suffering. That is, that's just that same cycle. The other is that clarity is valuable. And what can I do to support moving in that direction without having to have it right now? It's like it's more of an inspiration that we've seen that possibility, and that wanting to go towards that can have a skillfulness to it if it's not demanding it appear in a certain way at a certain time. That so that there's kind of two sides to this wanting, that it can support us to head in a direction, but again, it's the open-hearted feeling versus the contracted feeling that can be our guide. Does it feel like I'm moving in this direction with a sense of curiosity, wonder, and interest? Or do I have to have that clarity and it's not okay if I don't have it? We know the difference. Yeah. So, that that wanting, we, you know, sometimes in hearing about this teaching of wanting, we start getting this idea in our minds, wanting is bad, and whatever I want, I shouldn't do that. So if I want to be mindful, I shouldn't want to be mindful. You know, that wanting to be mindful can have a contracted quality to it, and we'll feel the suffering of that, or it can have a kind of a sense of, what will happen if I bring mindfulness here? What happens, you know, what that open-hearted kind of quality. So I often say, use suffering as your guide where wanting is concerned. And you'll know, you'll begin to know. And the, you know, that path of using suffering as your guide will begin to reveal subtler and subtler kinds of suffering. And we don't have to jump over and, you know, think we know what they are. It's when you feel the suffering, that's when to look at the holding, the craving around it.
So may our boundless hearts be open.
May our boundless hearts be open. Thank you. Thank you all.